on ENR's Critical Path podcast, we talk to a California construction industry veteran who is an ambassador, a diplomat, a peacemaker, sometimes akin to a marriage counselor, and also someone I consider a very good friend. This is Eileen Cho.
And I'm Jeff Yoders.
Welcome to an ENR Exec Talk. Today, our guest is Sam Hassoun. He is the founder and president of Global Leadership Alliance, Inc., specializing in the development and implementation of collaborative dispute mitigation systems for agencies, organizations, and construction projects. He started his engineering career with Bechtel and then joined Caltrans in 1988. He holds a certificate in mediation and conflict resolution from UC Berkeley. Sam, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Eileen.
Yeah, welcome.
Yes.
Thank you.
Oh, I forgot to mention that Sam was also one of our 2019 Top 25 newsmakers. You were amongst the unlucky batch of newsmakers who didn't get to have an in-person ceremony, you know, celebrating you. Remember those times, Sam?
I do, but it was still nice to be recognized by ENR and by you, Eileen. Thank you.
Oh, geez, well deserved. So Sam, I first met you when you were working on the Gerald Desmond Bridge replacement project. Obviously that project is thankfully done and the bridge is open. It's a beautiful bridge. What are you working on now these days?
Well, we are working on numerous projects. One of them is actually one of the largest highway project in the state of California. It's on the I-405 in Orange County. The owner agency is OCTA, Orange County Transportation Authority. And it is a joint venture with OHLA and Lane Construction that's doing the design build on this project. It is definitely fast moving. It's one of those going to be iconic projects where a lot of lessons learned will be gleaned from this project. Mm-hmm. The good news is the partnering part is going extremely well. It is actually conducted at the highest level on a monthly basis, Eileen. The CEO of OCTA, along with the director of Caltrans District 12, which is the Orange County, and the CEOs of both joint venture companies, we meet along with their top tier executives for 1 hour or less on a monthly basis to discuss not only what's working well, to also discuss potential risks, how to cast ahead, how to, as a team, look at the potential risks for the project. So it's no longer agency and contractor. It's actually a project focus. And it's amazing how when this collaboration does work, when you put the project first, everything seems to fall into place. And the team tends to take care of their commercial issues as they go. So it's no longer a disputed part as historically been the case. So this is probably one of the bigger ones. Also, we've been called back to help with the high-speed rail. And that will continue to be one of the legacy projects for the state of California, if not the nation.
Yeah, and these design build projects, that kind of teaming really is necessary. You have to have the collaboration, the project first attitude, because we're seeing a lot more of them, and they can really unlock those efficiencies if everyone is willing to communicate and be on the same page and put the project first, right?
That is exactly correct, Jeff. What we term, and we learned that actually from working with the military, is mission project first. If we put the project first and what's best for the project, and then we align all the resources and all the talent on the project to really make this project a showcase project, everybody wins. And that attitude, we need to continuously reinforce it at the opening and at the closing of every single partnering session. That's one. The second actually is a term that now we are moving into, which is dispute prevention versus dispute resolution in terms of the collaboration and partnering. And in it, we have to anticipate risks, known or unknown, and be in position to deploy all the resources needed to mitigate that risk if it does materialize. But that looking forward as a team, Jeff, really makes a huge difference in terms of dispute prevention. We don't have to wait for disputes to occur in order for us to jump in and to collaborate and to try to find a resolution to it. But the key to it is the frequency. So we no longer wait once a quarter or once every 3-4 months, or we will call you when we need you. It's becoming very preemptive and very proactive approach to partnering, whereby we are on the schedule with the regular weekly meeting or monthly meeting, however the project is designed. We become an integral part of the team, and we start looking at all the risks, all the potential disputes, and we nip them, deal with them immediately before they become issues. So that's basically the system that we are deploying on those projects.
Yeah, does that proactive answer your question? Versus reactive. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we want to be proactive, right?
Especially in our arena. Absolutely.
Well, Sam, you've been doing this for over 2 decades now. And I also did a 10 minutes interview with you where I asked you about, you know, cultural shifts and how long is it taking agencies and contractors to really embrace this approach. Since we last talked, which was, I guess, a couple of years ago in the before times, have you seen more progress with this shift?
As a matter of fact, we have, Eileen, especially in my opinion, agencies are the ones that set the tone. They are the ones that issue the contract for contractors to bid on. And if they state or spec partnering as one of the tenants or the components that contractors need to include in their bid, that's the first cornerstone, if you will. But at the very beginning, if the agency is embracing partnering and the benefits of it, and they have a strong why do they want to do that? And if the contractor, basically, for the most part, we find that industry will respond to the agency and to the tone and to the culture of that agency. And you will see in time how certain agencies have really excelled in the use of collaboration and partnering as a way of doing business and a way of constructing projects. So it's no longer adversarial. And they set that tone from the get-go. You will unleash a huge amount of talent and really innovation on the project, because the fear of disputes, claims, suits, lawsuits is basically gone. And now you're harnessing all this energy and all this talent on the project to come up with innovative solutions, sometimes not even in the spec, but it's amazing when that happens. So the shift has occurred, Eileen, at least from what I've seen in the last couple of years, especially as some of the younger generation has taken on some leadership roles, who grew up in a more partnering culture than adversarial, and they expect that to be the norm for their agency. And many of the industry is following suit. For industry, sometimes when they bid on projects that that particular local agency or small city or county or however the size agency does not have partnering, they ask, how come? Why? And then they ask me sometimes to give a presentation to that agency to show them the benefit of partnering and what's in it for the overall good. So even from a business standpoint and ROI, contractors are quickly finding out that it's a much better ROI for them to proactively pursue partnering than the old traditional way. And yes, the culture has shifted, Eileen.
Yeah, certainly good news that it has. how do you approach these owners, these contractors, these designers, you know, maybe in the old way where for whatever reason they just disagreed and mediation was necessary? And how did you build that trust, you know, when you were going in that situation with GLA, Sam? That's what I kind of wonder about when I seen your illustrious resume.
Well, interestingly, Jeff, when we talk to agencies and even at the kickoff, agencies and contractors alike, I asked them how this project was procured. Is it low bid? Is it best value? And for the most part, the culture that we have is still a low bid approach, Jeff, for predominantly the most of the projects. And then I asked the question, well, how much, Mr. Contractor, did you put in your bid for disputes? What was that amount? And typically, everybody says, what do you mean? No, we have zero budget for disputes, yeah. You know? And I asked the same question of the agency. In your contingency, in your engineer's estimate, in all the data that you've collected to select or to actually budget for this project, how much did you put for claims, disputes, and arbitration? And unanimously, the answer is no. And I said, yet, statistically and historically, you know, you pay for those and you deploy claims and you get attorneys involved and so forth. Where does this money come from? And it's a very uncomfortable discussion, but we have to put it on the table right from the get-go. And that evens out why we do what we do and why nobody ever intentionally budgets for disputes and for claims going into any project. We're in the business of building monuments, building infrastructure, building legacy projects to last for years and decades and generations to come. We don't build them to fight over and to create disputes and havoc throughout. So setting that tone from the get-go is really a very basic component in what we do, Jeff.
Yeah, having to hire attorneys and take on court costs and stuff is never cheap. And it can be a real eye-opener to a lot of people involved in these situations, I'd imagine.
But Sam, you know, it's one thing to, at the beginning, you know, sort of be proactive about perhaps entities that maybe were geared for adversarial at relationships. But have you ever, like in a marriage, right? People usually these days don't get married going, oh, we're going to get divorced someday. have you ever seen people well-meaningly enter into a project and then, oh my God, what happened? How did we start disagreeing with each other? And is that a different way of then resolving rather than just changing their attitude from the get-go?
Excellent question, Eileen. Oftentimes, the partnering or the collaboration that we do on projects is compared to a marriage, as you pointed out. People do not enter into a marriage relationship with the notion that one day we're going to get a divorce. And if we do, here's the prenuptial agreement and here's my attorney. And we're going to have this agreement from the get-go. However, on construction contracts, as I mentioned, oftentimes, you don't pick your mate. The agency still has to interview. They still have to go through a procurement process whereby it's the lowest bidder or the best value, whatever formula they choose, that has to be where who they end up with is who they end up with. Very rarely, they pick their mate or they pick their partner. So consequently, to get the partnering established from the get-go, knowing that divorce or arbitration, we said it from the get-go, you hired us, our mission is clear. If you go onto our website, our mission is to eradicate arbitration litigation from the construction industry, period. Not to minimize, not to reduce, but to eradicate. We consider it to be a disease, a pandemic, a plague, well before COVID even came about. Because it does erode, really, as I pointed out earlier, all the intellectual capabilities, all the skills, all the knowledge, and all the innovation that we can harness on a project by going through a dispute. So consequently, when that marriage is consummated, if you will, when that contract is signed with the partner, then we have to sit down and establish, number one, what is the definition of success? What do each entity or the stakeholders hope to achieve at the end of the project? And we actually discuss them in length. What does that look like? And how are we going to get there? So we have to have a strong why for the parties to do what they do. Otherwise, the what and the how can be different, but the why has to be very strong and very vivid and very clear to everyone. And when we have a unified why we're building this job, what's in it for all of us, what the success look like, it becomes much stronger to deal with disputes and issues when they occur. Because, but if we lose sight of that overarching, that commitment that we made at the beginning, and we still want to strive towards that regardless of what comes our way and collaboratively work on it, that's a much stronger relationship than otherwise. What does the spec say? What does the contract say? You owe me this, I owe you that, and therefore here's my claim. And that's the thing that we're, even though there's still contractual obligations that we have to fulfill, but we can fulfill them much easier, better, cheaper, and frankly, more enjoyable if we do it collaboratively.
Sam, do you find that the new options we have in construction technology, BIM and all these collaborative platforms, do they make building that trust easier? Or is this a situation where, hey, you know, there are new aspects involved to your business relationship, but they're pretty much the same as before, you know, deliverable wise.
Jeff, you brought up a good point. I am an advocate of the use of technology, frankly, in our industry, and we were lagging in terms of embracing tools or technological tools that we can deploy as a dispute prevention tools. You mentioned BIM. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. In the vertical and the commercial, we use a term, a GLA, we call it VTA, visibility, transparency, and accountability. And BIM, or similar tools, whether in the horizontal construction infrastructure and or vertical commercial, if the visibility is available to the entire project team where the conflict can occur, especially in during construction or in the field, it takes away from any potential he said, she said, you come first and you told me, and all the issues that go with it. So that visibility through the use of technology leads to building trust much easier. So the potential dispute tends to get reduced. And along with it comes with the transparency and accountability. Then we know who's on first, who's in second, who needs to do what to not only mitigate, but sometimes, frankly, to preempt and to accelerate some of our delivery. So yes, BIM, other tools, especially tools that are accessible and visible to the entire project team, along with the dashboard, have contributed significantly to reducing potential conflicts that we historically have seen in the past.
Yeah, you need the transparency and visibility. That's, you know, they bring them, and not everyone uses them, but they should.
Yeah, we push for those tools, and we actually do plugins. We try to utilize our partnering approach and the goals. We track the goals and the commitments that were made on the project, Jeff, early on, and we bring those tools to light every time we hold a partnering session. They use virtual tools now. I must admit that COVID did help accelerate, build a lot of what we're doing today, for example. Mm-hmm. Along with maybe tools that are becoming a lot more acceptable to use than historically been in the past.
I mean, that sounds almost, I've been thinking about that a lot myself. It seems almost kind of ironic, as awful as this pandemic was, it does seem like that would then, you know, make people be maybe more appreciative of connecting with each other, right? Rather than being stuck and isolated and unable to meet in person, and perhaps people who you felt like were potential adversaries, now you're like, oh my God, it's so good to see you, right?
Yeah. You're absolutely right, Eileen, in a sense that because of the pandemic, we've come to recognize that meeting in person was no longer an option. We needed to find an alternative way. So virtual, though, may not be a perfect or an exact substitute. However, the silver lining is meetings are a lot shorter, meaning we can get through a lot of our issues now on average, in less than 1 hour of a virtual meeting, we can achieve what we used to historically achieve in a half a day or sometimes longer duration in person, number one. Number two is there's still a time and a place for meeting in person. And one of the interesting stories that we had in one of our CMGC projects in San Luis Obispo is we went a year and a half from the beginning of the project, completely virtual on the screen using Zoom monthly. And then finally, when we had a chance for everybody to meet in person, which was actually in March of this year, the reaction of most people, oh my God, you're a lot taller than you look on the screen, Sam, or you really don't have hair. You had a little bit of hair, you know. So it's just the human interaction and the reaction to meeting in person after an extended period of virtual meetings was absolutely phenomenal. And the other interesting part is now we rely heavily on virtual meetings to really get things done. We use the in-person meetings for celebrations, for milestones, for other factors. So the shift in dynamics and the use and the utilization of virtual tools versus in-person have really shifted dramatically in the realm of partnering and collaboration.
Interesting. Sam, when we first started, you mentioned, you know, the military phrase of, you know, the mission being the project first. Did that come about from your time with Bechtel?
Actually, no, it came after because when I was brought in by some of our clients that I worked with in my days, even at Caltrans, who moved on and took on some military projects. Some of them are former Granite Construction or other contractors. Now they're dealing with federal contracts and they will fly me to Air Force bases or Navy bases or different. And it's a whole different command and control and different culture. And then when the meeting tone is established by the commander of the base and the phrase came mission project first, that really resonated with me. And frankly, I cloned it and used it on all of our other projects, and it was well received, Eileen.
Nice.
Yeah, Sam, I'd like to ask a little more about this this generational divide you mentioned earlier. The younger people, I think you're completely right. They're more willing to collaborate and more willing to trust their project partners. But we were talking about meetings a little bit before, and among just my colleagues that are younger, you do get a lot of the reaction that, well, this meeting could have been an email and they're wired that way. And is that something you're dealing with on a lot of projects today where, you know, if you're digital first, you don't want as much face-to-face collaboration as someone who came up in a meeting culture?
We're dealing with this transformation as we speak, Jeff, actually. And even on my team, I have three generations, and the facilitators that we brought in this year, they're all in their 20s, completely tech savvy, very comfortable with remote and digital devices, and in particular with phones. So here's what we found out. The older generation, my generation, if you will, we like handshakes. We like to have a social session. We like to build rapport. We like to do everything in person before we establish trust. The middle generation can actually do both. They can work remotely, as I cited our CMGC project in San Luis Obispo. And then when they met in person, it was like an instant and immediate. That trust has been built remotely via virtual devices, if you will. And then the in-person kind of sealed or solidified. The younger generation, they're far more comfortable in a metaverse environment. Mm-hmm. They are far more, they're actually dabbling with Web 3.0 and other technology spaces that maybe my generation is not as comfortable with. However, I'm finding out the one device that they're always connecting to is an app or some kind of a community that they can all collaborate with virtually. This is where we are investing, Jeff, and how do we actually harness and bring in the younger generation into our industry that we are so proud of. The construction industry, in my opinion, is by far the one that not only builds civilizations, but also creates jobs and builds infrastructure and so forth. So attracting the youth into doing what we do, we have to be open-minded to the use of technology, as uncomfortable and as scary as it may seem to some older generation, but we're doubling down and investing in that heavily. And to confirm your earlier point, Jeff, they're a lot more comfortable collaborating virtually, even they haven't met each other, than they would maybe socially. And sometimes it's awkward that when we bring them all together afterwards, how do we get them to shake hands or say hello or, you know?
Yeah, it can be. And yeah, I think those middle people you were talking about are really important, because they can sort of have one foot in both camps and kind of bring everyone together. At least,
Jeff, I think you're talking about our generation, Generation X.
Gen X.
That's right, damn it. We do have one foot in the before and the after. So, but Sam, this is a question I love to ask pretty much every guest we have. How did you get into this industry?
So, Eileen, I grew up in the Middle East, and the Middle East was a developing, in fact, my father landed a job in Kuwait in the early 50s, where Kuwait wasn't even a country. It was still a British colony. And at the time, those developing countries in the Gulf and in the Middle East relied heavily on civil engineers, mechanical engineers, to build infrastructure. So my dad was a mechanical engineer, and all of his siblings were engineers. But one in particular, one of his brothers, came to the States, and he is a civil engineer, and went to Michigan, got his PhD, went back to the Middle East, and really ran big infrastructure projects. He was, if you will, my idol, my mentor. And as a result, I grew up knowing that I'm going to be a civil engineer. And then when I moved to the States, he was one of my coaches, one of my mentors, because he too moved to the U.S. about the same time and became a university professor teaching civil engineering as well, wrote multiple books. So civil engineering, building infrastructure projects, was one that was in my DNA, if you will, or kind of was one of those that a lot of my peers, my generation at the time, and my parents' generation embraced, because it was needed. And it was for many of the Palestinian refugees earlier in those days, it was a meal ticket. If you are an engineer or a doctor, you're more than likely can survive in any country, since we didn't have really a country until we came to the U.S. So fast forward, it was one thing that I absolutely enjoyed, and working for Bechtel was a dream come true. But then shifting into partnering and dispute prevention and dispute resolution was as a result of what I personally experienced in the field in terms of conflicts. And it took away from all this passion that I had in seeing projects to fruition, in really celebrating an accomplishment, whether a bridge or a nuclear plant or a facility of any kind. Why does it have to be so painful to get to the finish line? And that was really the beginning of the alternative dispute resolution movement, if you will. But I was fortunate, when I was in Caltrans, I had a director who was a retired Army Corps of Engineers general. And he noticed that the number of arbitrations and disputes were going sky high on Caltrans projects. And he brought me in, he says, nope, there's a better way. It's called partnering. We piloted that at the Army Corps. Find a way to make it happen. As they say, and the rest is history, Eileen.
Wow.
Yeah, and you know, when you see a project as important as the 405 in Orange County. You know, you don't ever have a problem, you know, knowing the significance of your work there with, you know, the millions of riders that take it every week.
Let's not forget the Gerald Desmond Bridge. That was super important for Long Beach and for Southern California, and really, and by extension, for the whole country, since a whole lot of cargo is transported over that bridge.
Without a doubt. And we worked also on the Bay Bridge during the reconstruction. Ironically, I worked on the Bay Bridge during Loma Prieta earthquake I was still with Caltrans, and then worked years thereafter to put the new segment, the new bridge, and the Gerald Desmond, the mm-hmm. one that Eileen has mentioned. Mm-hmm. What a great monumental bridge.
Yes, it's not only gorgeous and, you know, our first major vehicular cable state bridge in Southern California, but I remember being driven over the old bridge. Oh my God, if one car broke down, you're screwed. You know, there was no mm-hmm. shoulders, nowhere to go. So Sam, speaking also of books, you said that your uncle had written some books. You were working on a book the last time I talked to you for the 10 minutes with. How's that book going?
Actually, not as fast as some of our other projects are going, but it is, the book is called The Ambassador, How to Become the Envoy of Your Industry and Why Does Your Survival Depend on It? It is actually, hopefully, will be completed this year, Eileen. Thank you for bringing this up. That book is geared towards how do we, regardless of our professions or the career or the particular industry that we're in, can become true advocates and ambassadors for that particular profession or industry? And how do we get to attract other people to join? What is it that we are enjoying, especially if we believe in it? Mm-hmm. So it's a combination of professionalism, passion, but more importantly, looking forward. I did read a book by Peter Diamantis a while back. It's called Abundance. The future is way better than you think. And I truly believe in that. And hopefully the book will put more realism into for everyday people as to how they can turn any job or any place that they worked at into a place where they can shine and become the ambassador for that particular profession or career that they embrace.
Awesome. Well, I think we're running down this podcast time, and Sam, always a pleasure to talk with you. I can't believe it's been several years now since we've been colleagues, and hopefully it'll be many more years to come. And I look forward to your book coming out and throw a book party. I'll be there.
Yeah, looking forward to one of those milestone meetings, you know?
Yes. Hello.
yes, indeed. And I want to thank you both, Eileen and Jeff, for the opportunity to talk to you this morning. It's always a delight. And you have a way of really tapping and igniting some of my passions. So if that came across through this podcast, then the mission was accomplished.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah, pleasure was all on this side of the table. This was great.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you, Eileen. Thank you, Jeff.
This has been another Critical Path podcast. I'm Eileen Cho.
And I'm Jeff Yoders. For more podcasts, go to enr.com/podcasts or follow us on Apple and Spotify.
As always, thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.